This message is brought to you by Whiting Community Church in Whiting, Vermont. Real people, real faith. Here's Pastor Billy Jones.
Genesis chapter 29. You've been going so fast here the last couple weeks, you've had to put your seatbelt on. I mean, it took about 6 months to get through the first three chapters, I think. So we've been covering multiple chapters in a week. It's better hang on for your life moving through these chapters here. We've gone through Adam and Eve and the history building up to Abraham, spent quite a while on Abraham. Then we saw Isaac coming to the picture, he's not much talked about Isaac, and Jacob is really a main character, so we're going to spend some time on Jacob. That's our topic this morning. We'll look at a particular incident in his life. Last week we talked about his dream, when he had the dream moment, when he's running, you know, being chased out of town by his brother Esau for fear of his life. And so we're looking at Jacob here. You know, let me ask you this question. How many of you would consider yourself a role model? A good role model for others to look at and to model their life after? How many of us would consider ourselves a good role model? Well, I've got an interesting role model for you here today in Jacob. He's a patriarch. He's a founder, a father of our faith, if you will. Third in line from Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob. Turns out that this role model was a married man. Twice. At the same time. To sisters, nonetheless. You know, guys, next time your wife's getting on to you, you can say, well, at least I didn't marry your sister too, you know. So, I don't know. To top it all off, at the suggestion of his sister wives, isn't that a TV show? Oh my goodness. At the suggestion of his sister wives, he had a couple more ladies on the side, this role model of ours, and his wives were okay with it to boot. Boy, it's getting messed up now. In fact, you know, they suggested the whole idea. Did I mention that his wives were sisters? Did I mention that? Oh my goodness. You guys have any advice for this guy?
Flee, run.
Oh my goodness. Perhaps a better question would be, would he have any advice for us? Maybe we can, could we possibly learn anything positive from a man like this? You know, could we learn anything? What if I told you that, you know, this guy is one of the most famous guys in all of history? Everyone knows the story of Jacob. The man God would actually rename and give the name Israel. Everyone's heard that name. God gives him a new name. It's Israel. Let's look at Genesis chapter 29. Genesis chapter 29, verses 1 through 30. Let's read through it really quickly, and then we'll hit the high spots on the way back through. Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples. There he saw a well in the field and the three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well. And the stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. And they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. And Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. And he said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him well," they answered. Then Jacob asked them, "Is he well?" "He is, yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep." "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It is not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to pasture." "We can't wait," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. And then we will water the sheep." And while he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And when Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah, so she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him, and he embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home, and there Jacob told him all these things. Then Laban said to him, "You are my own flesh and blood." And after Jacob had stayed with him for a whole month, Laban said to him, "Just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be." Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. And Laban said, it's better that I give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. And then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. My time is completed. I want to lie with her. So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob, and Jacob lay with her. And Laban gave his servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as her maidservant. When morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, What is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? And Laban replied, it is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Finish the daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work. And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife, and Laban gave his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maidservant. And Jacob lay with Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he worked for Laban another 7 years. Can you say dysfunctional? And you thought you had a dysfunctional family, right? I'm pretty sure, just taking a wild guess, that no one here has anything that touches this dysfunctional family. And it only gets worse as we go. You know, as we read this section, we're actually confronted right off the bat with an issue that I think in the next few years will become the next step in a battle that is linked to the gay marriage debate. You know, if gay marriage becomes mainstream in our country, which it seems like it will, our culture is degraded to that point, then the next thing we will be dealing with will be polygamy. And so it's an interesting topic that we need to have a biblical stance on, a biblical position. And, you know, you can already hear the argument that's going to come from it. You know, the Bible very clearly condemns homosexuality. But people are going to say, well, the Bible condones polygamy. You know, how could you be against it? The Bible's for it. And is that a true statement? We need to be ready for that. And I need to keep you to keep in mind that throughout the Bible, monogamy is the biblical idea for marriage. Monogamy meaning one husband, one wife, for life. Genesis 2 contains it, as it were, as the very first wedding. And in it, God created one woman for one man. And he puts together, let no man take and pull asunder. Ephesians chapter 5 and chapter 6 details the ideal family, which one would include one man and one woman. And the requirement for church leadership is to be one man with one woman. You find that in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 2 and 12, and also in Titus chapter 1 and verse 6. These are biblical mandates, biblical principles that have been established. So monogamy is the biblical position. You know, contrast that with all of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac was monogamous, but Jacob and all the way on down through the kings of Israel. King Solomon, which was the ultimate crazy guy, he had 1,000 wives and concubines, remember? 1,000. I don't even know how you remember their names. It's crazy. In many places, you know, the scripture reports that did happen. And it does not ever imply that it should happen. It records that it did, but it does not imply that it should, and that is a big difference. Jacob, no less than any other instance where polygamy in the Bible was emphasized, does not emphasize the goodness of polygamy, but it does illustrate the problems of polygamy. And that's important for us to look at. We're not told specifically, but you can imagine the hurt that Leah must have felt being in that relationship, knowing that she was the wingman, knowing that she was the consolation prize, runner-up in that marriage. You know how deep her hurt was by the fact that she flaunted her ability to have children over her beloved sister Rachel, and the fact that there was that constant antagonism between the two of them. You may be more loved, but look, I can give him children, and then throwing handmaids at the poor guy and children everywhere, and ended up with 12 sons and then additional daughters. I mean, it was just a crazy, crazy family, dysfunctional, dysfunctional. Polygamy is not to be heralded, this story and others. I mean, look at the fall of King Solomon. His many, many wives actually tore the nation of Israel down because of their influence of the foreign gods that they brought into the nation. So every time that polygamy is mentioned in Scripture, it is to illustrate the wrongness of it and how it goes against God's plan and the consequences of it. Now, and that isn't the point of the message. We're not talking about polygamy today. We're talking about something else. But I felt like I had to address it. We had to talk about it. It's there. We need to go ahead and take the lid off that can and air it out a bit. You know, for all its simplicity, this passage really is an example of how God can take broken lives and bring to Him purposeness, a fulfillment of purpose. In that last chapter that we studied, we talked about Jacob and how God promised him that he would multiply his descendants. And we talked about how Jacob was too blessed to be used by God. He had too many riches, too many things going on for himself. We talked about how he needed to have a place of discomfort. He needed to find that certain place where all he had was a rock to use as a pillow. An uncomfortable situation that would grab his attention so that he could be used by God. And it was in that uncomfortable place that God was actually able to give him the promise. And that promise of, I will bless the entire world through your descendants. Your descendants will be innumerable. You will not be able to count them. More than the sands of the sea, more than the stars in the sky. And God is promising him, really, that he's going to make all things work together for his good, for God's good. Romans 8, chapter 8, verse 28. Even with less than perfect circumstances. That's what I love about God. That's what I love about the Bible. He takes this dysfunctional mess of a family, Jacob, a trickster on the lam, running for his life, getting into more trouble, marrying two women and two concubines to boot, and all these marital problems, and God is going to use this man to save the world. Isn't that amazing? And you're sitting there, well, God could never use me. Really? Are you kidding me? Anyone here married to four women at the same time? I don't think so. Don't raise your hand if you are. Woo! It is here that, you know, Jacob, the new man, begins his transformation as God begins to fulfill that promise through the wives that he obtains, ultimately through the children born through those unions, even though it's not God's perfect plan. Perfect plan, one man, one woman for life. Jacob doesn't follow that plan, but God still uses him. God works through the mess. God works around the mess. You know, even though Jacob is the visible lead character in this story, don't be mistaken. Don't miss it. Even though it seems he's the main character, you know who the main character is in this story? God. And God's always the main character. In every Bible story you read, and even in your life, God's the main character. It's all about his work in our lives. The same pattern develops here that we saw with Abraham and that we saw with Isaac. God makes a promise and then he keeps it. And it's interesting that God is rarely mentioned throughout all of this. Very rarely do you even see God's name wrapped up in this narrative. But this story is intentionally sandwiched between chapter 28 and Jacob's recognition of God's guidance in chapter 31, which we're going to get to eventually, Grace. Eventually. We'll get there. In which God affirms that he is indeed taking care of Jacob. And Jacob will acknowledge that in chapter 31. It's a story, it's Jacob's story, and it's Jacob's struggle, and it's in that struggle that we find a parable for our own lives. And we can identify with this guy. And the drama of this patriarch's transformation from deceitful schemer, stealing blessings and stealing birthrights and trading things for pots of porridge, we see him transformed to a humbled servant of God. And you know what? It was painful for him. We're going to see that. It was painful just as our own transformation is. Has God brought you to that certain place where you've had a rock for a pillow, metaphorically speaking? Have you gone through the painful transformation? Are you in the midst of a painful transformation maybe right now? Then this message is certainly for you. For a man that was used to doing things his way, disregarding any moral liability, learning to trust in God was not automatic. This guy struggled. It isn't automatic for us either, is it? No. But through struggles recorded here for our encouragement, we can learn that God's way is not only the best way, but it's the only way that works anyway. First thing I want you to see is that when God is leading you, God is always on target. When God is leading you, He is always on target. Look at verses 1 and 2. Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples. And there he saw a well in the field with three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well. And the stone over the mouth of the well was large. Remember, God told him where to go. God guided him. He said in that vision, continue in the way you're going. And you know, we all know this. That God's leading is always on target. But don't we worry as well that God might be leading and we worry about where it's going? Where's the destination? What's going to be there? What's it going to look like? What's it going to hold for me? Am I going to be asked to be made uncomfortable? Is there going to be sacrifice involved? Am I going to be unhappy where God leads? Aren't these questions that we ask as we walk this Christian walk, as we travel this journey that He's given us to have? You know, I think Jacob is not that much different than we are today. I think it's naturally, he understood that there was risk involved, that there was problems to be had. And remember back in chapter 28, verses 15 and 20, that first God and then Jacob made a covenant between them that God would protect him, that God would take care of him, that God would provide for him food and clothes and shoes and all of those things. And then Jacob says, well, if you do that and that and that and that, and he relisted everything God had promised, then I will follow. So it's a covenant that they've made between them. And Jacob is going to take this journey. He's all in. He's committed. And then in the first verse in chapter 29 literally says that Jacob lifted his feet. So there he is, head on the rock. He wakes up, crazy dream, realizes what it means. He lifted his feet. It's an intentional word picture informing us that Jacob moved with a specific purpose. And I think that specific trust that God would be faithful to him as God led. Do you have that kind of faith? Do you believe that God's leading is always going to be on target? That if God asks you to do something, if He puts it in your heart and your mind and it's clear through circumstances and through prayer that you're supposed to do a certain thing, whether it's witnessing to a neighbor or making a financial decision or whatever He's asking you to do, do you have the faith to know that His leading is always on target? He's not going to miss. He's not going to make a mistake. He's not going to lead you and say, oh, didn't see that coming. That isn't our God. God doesn't operate that way. And we can see that in this story. You know, even though Jacob did the walking, God did the leading. And Jacob ended up at precisely the right spot at precisely the right time. He's going where God has told him to go, and he shows up at the well. And he's like, he doesn't even know where he is. He has to ask the other shepherds. There's sheep everywhere. There's shepherds everywhere. They're all sitting around. It's the heat of the day. The big, gigantic rock is over the well. And he says, where am I? Isn't that great? No GPS. Or maybe a battery went dead. I don't know. And he's recalculating, you know. And he shows up there at the well, and he's like, where am I? Haran. Oh, really? I'm in Haran? That's where I was going. Imagine that. The guy got there and he didn't even have anyone to help him get there, you know. I depend on my wife to help me get places. Her and the GPS fight, and between the two of them, they get me where I'm going. He didn't have that. He makes it. And he says, do you know Laban? Yeah, we know Laban. He's a good friend of ours. Really? Oh, wow. God put me right here where I need to be. In fact, you see that pretty girl coming this way, that's his daughter. Why did he go to see Uncle Laban? To get a wife. Pretty girl, Laban's daughter. This is working out just like it was planned or something. She walks up and he's like, you guys, water your sheep. Get out of here. Quick, get out of here. I want to talk to Rachel and I want to talk to her alone. And they're like, no, there's not enough of us. It's the wrong time of day. We got to wait later in the afternoon for more shepherds to come because the rock's big. We got to have all the shepherds to roll this rock out of the way. And he's like, forget that. And Jacob was a manly man. Don't think of Jacob, even though, you know, in comparison to Esau, he's the smooth-skinned one. And always think of Jacob as being the weakly little guy because he's a mama's boy, you know. Jacob was a manly man. He looks at that rock and he single-handedly grabs the rock and moves it out of the way because Rachel's coming. And I think he waited until she got close enough that he could flex while he was doing it. You know what I'm saying? Arr, you know, impress Rachel as she comes up. And she was like, oh, yeah, my hero, you know. You got the picture. What's that? Rachel, arr. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, that was how it happened. Exactly. That's what Scripture tells us how it happened. God led him exactly to the right place at exactly the right time and set up the circumstances so that he could do exactly the right thing just by being himself to see God's plan fulfilled. You can trust God's leading because it's always on target. I would call all of that providence, wouldn't you? Some would call it coincidence. I would call it providence. But let me ask you, do you believe that God will lead you in that way? Oh, that's a Bible story. That's Jacob. That's not me. Has God changed? Does God change? We believe in the doctrine of the immutability of God, meaning that God does not change, ever. And he relates to you in the same exact way that he relates to Jacob. And he will not lead you astray. His leadership will always be right on target. You know, chapter 3, verse 6 says, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Not crooked, not branchy, not spaghetti noodles, straight. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 3, commit your works to the Lord, and your plans will be established. You serve God, you make him your priority, you say, God, I'm going where you tell me to go, your plans will be made. God will lead you, and he will not lead you astray. God's leading is always on target. You know what else? God's timing is always perfect. His timing's always perfect. Verse 9, while he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. Keep in mind that it was about the best they could travel, the best they could hope to travel was 40 miles in a day. And looking back at 28 verse 10, it would have taken at least 10 days of hard travel for Jacob to get to that well. But look at how perfect this timing is. While he was still talking, out comes Rachel. Coincidence again, right? No, God's timing is always perfect. It's providence. Jacob had agreed to let God run his life, and now God was running it. It shouldn't surprise us. God's timing and direction were perfect for Abraham's servant back in chapter 24 of Genesis. And it was perfect when Ruth shows up in Boaz's field in the book of Ruth. Its timing is perfect for his plans in our lives. Even when we don't even know it, his timing is perfect. And you know what? Unfortunately, the results aren't always so blatant. But we can take this example and we can rest in it, especially when timing is important. God will not be late, but you know what? And I've learned this in my own life, and it frustrates me. God isn't early either. He's never late. He's never early. He's right on time every time. Don't you wish he would show up early sometimes? But he won't, because his timing is perfect. The arrival of Jesus came at the perfect time in history. Galatians chapter 4 verse 4, but when the time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under law. But when the time had fully come, it was prescribed before the foundation of the earth were laid when Christ would come. It was preordained. He died at the perfect time as well. Romans chapter 5, verse 6, at just the right time when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. At just the right time. Not a day earlier, not a day later. At just the right time. God's timing is always perfect. I think of Lazarus. You remember the story of Lazarus and Mary and Martha weeping and wailing and bawling and screaming and tears and snot everywhere. And Jesus shows up. Where were you? You're late. He's been in the grave 3 days. Was he late? No, he's just right on time. He had a job for Lazarus. He had to get up out of that tomb right on time. Thirdly, I want you to see that God's provision is always sufficient. God's provision is always sufficient. Genesis 29:13 says, as soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him, and he embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home, and there Jacob told him all these things. You know, I'll just share this briefly. If you take a look back at the 13th verse that we just read there, Laban took him into his house. Again, we look back at 28:20, where Jacob trusted God for food to eat and garments to wear. It was in Laban's somewhat dubious care, you could say, that Jacob was clothed and that he was fed for the next 20 years. God's keeping his word. God's provision is sufficient. I want to ask for a raising of hands, but answer this question in your heart. How many of you worry about daily provision, that God's going to provide for your needs? How many of you stress out about money, about finances, about all that stuff? If you're serving Him and He's the top priority in your life, you'll be taken care of. Jesus very clearly said that not a sparrow falls from the sky without His Father knowing about it. And if He cares that much for a bird, how much more does He care about you? Don't worry about those things. If you're called according to His purpose, all things are going to work together for His glory, for the good of those who are called, you know? If you're serving Him, if you've made your life a testimony for Him, a picture of His glory, if you're focused on serving Him and Him alone, you don't have to worry about a thing. You don't have to worry about a thing. I'm not saying you're going to be rich, but you don't have to worry about those provisions. His provisions will always be sufficient. I will tell you, though, His idea of sufficient and your idea of sufficient might be two different things. You can trust Him. You can trust Him. God's leading is always on target. His timing is always perfect. His provision is always sufficient. But the problem is, He's leading, guiding, and providing for people who aren't perfect. You know? He's leading and guiding and providing for people that just aren't perfect. Max Lucado's book a few years ago entitled Just Like Jesus had a great tagline in it. Jesus loves you just the way you are, he says. But then he adds, but he loves you too much to leave you that way. He loves you just the way you are, but don't forget, he loves you too much to leave you that way too. God's goal for your life is to change you, to change who you are on the inside, to make you look like him, to make you reflect the glory of God. To take a dirty, stained, cracked mirror and to restore it and to polish it so that you will reflect the glory of your Creator. That's what we were designed. We were made in the image of God. Our original before pre-sin flawedness, we reflected His image. We reflected His glory. He wants to restore us to that. God's going to have to teach and correct us sometimes. He did Jacob. That brings me to my next point. God's correction is always gracious. God's correction is always gracious. Look at verse 21 through 25. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to lie with her." So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob, and Jacob lay with her. And Laban gave a servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as a maidservant, and when morning came, that has to be one of the most comical to me. I don't know. I have a warped sense of humor. That's one of the most comical passages in Scripture to me. When morning came, there was Leah, exclamation point. Can you imagine being Jacob? So Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me, man?" That's the Billy Jones translation. "I served you for Rachel. Why have you deceived me?" He's panicking at this point. He's freaking out a little bit. It says that Leah was weak in the eyes. We don't know what that means. It could mean that she was couldn't see well. This is before glasses, remember. So she bumped into things all the time. Maybe she was scarred up. She had fallen off a few cliffs here and there. Maybe it also could mean that she was just not easy on the eyes. That's a possibility. She, you know, one eye was a little higher than the other. I don't know. She struggled, okay, with things. But Leah, Rachel, her sister, the younger sister, was just drop-dead gorgeous. That's the prize. That's what he wanted. That's what he desired. That's what he bargained for. Isn't it just like God to teach a trickster a lesson by using another trickster? His correction is always gracious. He serves us 7 years. He demands his bride. He goes to the wedding. He goes home in the dark to await his bride. And when she came in, she's covered from head to toe in one of those burqa things that we know about today. Or it's too dark to tell. Maybe he had too much of the wedding wine. Maybe that was it. He was just drunk out of his head and didn't know the difference. But he only had one thing on his mind, and that was honeymoon. That was it. One thing, honeymoon. Apparently, she never made a sound, because it's not until they've consummated the marriage and the sun has risen that Jacob turns to look on his beloved Rachel and sees to his horror that he just slept with her sister. Wow, the deceiver has been deceived. He has argued with Laban. As he argued with Laban, I imagine a knowing knot formed in his stomach. I'm not getting out of this. I'm stuck with Leah. God is not the author of sin, but he is able to take the trickery of an evil man and use it in his favor. Do not be deceived. God does it all the time. People think they manipulate God and work against God. You can't work against God. God can use your evil for good. That's what makes him God. That's exactly what God did with Laban's dishonest tactics, using them to teach Jacob a lesson. The deceiver's own treacheries turned back on his head, and now it's his turn to suffer someone else's dishonesty. And from time to time, we need correcting too, don't we? You know, it isn't when you turn 18 and you cease to be a child, all of a sudden it doesn't mean that we're, you know, I'm an adult now, I never need to be corrected again. It didn't work that way. Man, I've seen a lot of adults that need more correcting than the children around. Go to Walmart. Oh my goodness. Sometimes the Lord uses difficulties that we face to carve away the sins in our lives. Why am I going through all this struggle? Why am I going through all this hard time? He's trying to shape you. He's trying to change you. He's giving you a circumstance to change your character. That's what he did to Jacob here. The Lord uses difficulties oftentimes to carve away the sin in our lives. In short, God punishes those he loves. Just as a father punishes a child because he doesn't want to see a child go the wrong way. I got to speed this thing up or I'm not going to get you out of here in time like I'm supposed to. But it's fun. This Jacob story is great, isn't it? Such a blast. Look with me at Hebrews chapter 12, verse 11. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Parents, if your discipline of your children isn't painful, you aren't doing it right, by the way. Hebrews, no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. The lesson wasn't over with this wife swap deal. It continued as God wore away at Jacob's pride for the next 13 years. In everything Jacob did, as continually, over and over and over, Laban deceives him. Right to the end, right as they're running away, we're going to study that, right as they're trying to get away, they sneak off at night so that Uncle Laban won't know. And right at the end, he's tricking them and deceiving them and just being a total pain in Jacob's life. And God is using that to change Jacob because he has a plan for Jacob. He's going to give him a new name. His name is going to be Israel. And he's going to be the father of Joseph. And the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, through it all, God's sustaining grace on Jacob, combined with Jacob's focus on the prize, Rachel, he learned that God's reward is worthy of the work. God's reward is worthy of the work. Verse 18 says, Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I will work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Verse 20, so Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. You know, it was Jacob's love for Rachel that fueled 14 years of uncomfortable, deceitful servitude. And all the years seemed like just a few days because of his love for Rachel. Do you grow tired of working for God? These are my closing thoughts so you can get comfortable. May I suggest that we all grow tired of working when we take our eyes off of the reward. We all grow tired of working when we take our eyes off the prize. Isn't that the cause of so much of our discontent in life? First, we take our eyes off the goal of eternity. Then we change our work into some kind of volunteer service. And then we begin to start feeling as if we're doing the church a favor by doing anything. Well, those people just don't appreciate my gifts and my talents. They should be more appreciative of my time that I have given to them. Isn't that the attitude of a lot of Christians today? They should realize I'm doing them a favor by showing up at this ministry or that. And the next thing you know, you're just half doing the work because you don't feel appreciated. You know, if you don't feel appreciated, you're not going to do a good job. So you're just half doing the work. And then the next thing you know, you just give it up altogether and you abandon that ministry because no one appreciated it anyway. And the rewards are lost and the opportunity is squandered because you've lost sight of the true reward. And that is the crowns in heaven that were promised. It is God's favor that is the reward. It is our service to Him and the reward of knowing that we're pleasing a righteous and holy God and fulfilling our purpose that He created us for. That is the reward, not the praise of man. That's just chaff. Blows away in the wind. Have you lost sight of the rewards of eternity? It's time to readjust our vision. Can you say you're working for Christ? Can you say that it is for the kingdom of God that you strive and that you serve? And if not, then what are you working for? We need a goal worth working for. Paul wrote to the Corinthians in chapter 9, verse 24 of 1 Corinthians, remember that in a race everyone runs, but only one person gets the prize. You also must run in such a way that you will win. All athletes practice strict self-control. They do it to win a prize that will fade away. But we do it for an eternal prize. Don't forget what you're working for. Our service to God is to be a labor of love. And the only way to ensure that is to labor for a prize worth having. And your service to the King won't be unreasonable if you are laboring for a crown that will not ever pass away. Philippians 2 verse 12 says, therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to His good purpose. What's your purpose in life? What are you striving for? What are your efforts being spent doing? Is it serving the Master? Is it serving the King? You know, as God has called you to serve Him, He's going to lead you to the right place at the right time. He will supply your every need. And when you wonder, He'll correct you graciously with the goal of renewal and restoration. And when the journey's hard, and when it seems like your work is unappreciated and undervalued, turn your eyes on Jesus. Readjust your focus. Look to the Lamb of God. He's the goal for which we labor. He is the Master that we serve. But you know what? We have to go back to the beginning of what I first said and learn to let Him lead. Learn to let Him lead.
This presentation is brought to you by Whiting Community Church. Real people, real faith. We are located in the heart of Whiting, Vermont, on Route 30. Sunday school classes start at 9:30, following a time of coffee and fellowship. Our Sunday morning worship service starts at 10:30. Join us for a midweek Bible study on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Learn more about our thriving small group ministries, gathering throughout the week in Whiting, Orwell, Cornwall, Shoreham, Sudbury, and Brandon. To learn more about Whiting Community Church, please contact Pastor Billy Jones at 802-623-7171. Or you may reach us on the web at wccvt.com and at Facebook/Whiting Church. Thank you, and may God bless you.